Welcome to the weekend edition of the Price of Business Show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. On today's program, we got a lot to cover, as always, and looking forward to introducing you to today's guests. But in addition to that, I do want to mention that the Price of Business, which is one of the longest-running business shows in the country, continues 24/7 at priceofbusiness.com. We are adding new content all the time. There you can see all of our regular guests. We have reoccurring guests from Fox Business, from Yahoo Finance, gentlemen like Cody Willard, who was a longtime CNBC and Fox Business anchor. He's on this program every single week. And so we're excited by the talent that we bring you. Also, I do want to mention I've got a book called Making New Rich Books Work for You, and exclusively for our listeners of this program. It's available at a ridiculously low price. If you want to get more information about that, go to priceofbusiness.com. If you read anything by people like Tim Ferriss or Robert Kiyosaki, who's been on my show many, many times, and you know, really were excited but had little to show for it when you try to pursue those things, my book explains why. There's something going on, and the problem really isn't with these authors. It's usually with the reader. And you can get more information about that at priceofbusiness.com. With that, here's our first guest right here on The Price of Business.
Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. I want to remind you, The Price of Business continues 24/7 at priceofbusiness.com, where we're always adding new audio, video, articles, and more. While there, make sure you sign up for our newsletter, Read Instead, which brings you the best to the Price of Business digital network, which includes great guests, like my guest in segment who it can also be found over there at priceofbusiness.com. Elizabeth Feed, good to talk to you today. You're with a company called DPSearch.com, and you have a really innovative product and a very mature product. I mean, this isn't brand new, but it's still doing things that a lot of other companies say they'd like to do. So I love what you guys do. Start off with the elevator speech, if you will, a panoramic overview of what DT Search is all about, and then introduce our topic today, and welcome.
Sure, thanks. DT Search has enterprise and developer products that run on-premises or on cloud platforms to instantly search terabytes of office files, PDFs, emails, along with nested attachments, databases, and online data. Because DT Search can instantly search terabytes with over 25 different concurrent search options, many of our customers are Fortune 100 companies and government agencies, but anyone with lots of data to search can download a fully functional 30-day evaluation copy from dtsearch.com.
And today's topic.
Yeah, whatever else you may have in your toolbox for organizing data, you still need enterprise search. Nothing matches the deep dive enterprise search can provide to every corner of an organization's content. Enterprise Search offers instant multi-threaded concurrent searching spanning terabytes, running from a traditional network, a local web server, or the cloud like Azure or AWS. However it runs, Enterprise Search enables instant concurrent searching across terabytes only after indexing the data.
So how do you get Enterprise Search to index the data?
All you need to do is point to the folders and the like to index, and the indexer will take it from there. No need to even tell the indexer what file types it is working with. The indexer on its own can figure out the exact mix of PDFs, word processing documents, spreadsheets, databases, presentation files, note files, compressed files, emails plus attachments, etc.
Wow. Yeah, that's impressive. So talk a little bit about remote files. Elaborate on that.
Yeah, so long as files appear in the Windows folder system, the indexer can handle any mix of local and remote data, like Dropbox files, SharePoint attachments, and Office 365 documents. Importantly, indexing doesn't move around or otherwise alter the original data. The indexer doesn't even need to retrieve files in their associated applications. Instead, indexing goes directly to the binary formats of files. Accessing the binary formats alone, the indexer parses each file to identify all specific words and numbers and record the location of each in the data.
What about capacity?
A single DT search index can hold up to a terabyte of text, covering both local and remote files. And there are no limits on the number of indexes that the software can create and end users can instantly and concurrently search. While indexing is resource intensive, multi-threaded searching is resource light. In fact, automatic index updates can accommodate new files, deleted files, and edited files, while concurrent searching continues uninterrupted.
So the whole process can proceed automatically?
That's the idea. To parse each file, the indexer needs to figure out its exact file format. But it can do that based on the information in the binary format itself. It won't even matter if a file has a mismatched file extension, like a Word document saved with a .pdf extension, or a PowerPoint saved with a .doc extension, .docx extension. Indexing can also work automatically with both individual files as well as recursively nested files. The data can include an email with a zip or RAR attachment, including a Word document, recursively embedding an Excel spreadsheet, and the binary format access will let the indexer pick up all of that.
And what about metadata?
Yeah, file metadata, even very obscure metadata that you might miss clicking around a document in its associated application, is readily available in the binary format for the indexer to process. The indexer can also retrieve items like track changes or redactions where the original text persists in a file, even if that text would not ordinarily appear in the file's associated application. The indexer can further find text that someone might have actively tried to hide, like white text against a white background or blue text against a blue background. And the indexer can also identify image-only PDFs requiring OCR through a program like Adobe Acrobat for full text processing.
And can the indexer automatically handle text in different languages?
Yeah, current file formats all use Unicode to encode hundreds of international languages. A file or an email can proceed through any number of Unicode encodings, English, other European languages, right-to-left languages like Hebrew and Arabic, double byte text like Chinese, Japanese, or Korean, and other international languages. Unicode will track all of that, enabling Enterprise Search to identify the Unicode encodings from binary format access.
Interesting. And what types of search features does DT Search offer?
Yeah, DT Search has over 25 different search options. These include natural language search request processing, as well as handling highly structured phrase, Boolean and or not, and proximity search requests. Search across the full text of everything or require that certain search elements appear in specific metadata. Concept searching extends a search request to similar words or concepts. Fuzzy searching adjusts from 1 to 10 to pick up potential typographical or OCR errors like tool BUX box for toolbox.
Gotcha. And what about numbers?
Numeric range searching looks for individual numbers or numbers in a range, like 18 to 36. Date and date range searching operates automatically across popular date formats, enabling a date range search covering November 30th, 2024 to October 9th, 2025 to retrieve not only January 15th, 2025, but also Jan 15, 2025 and 1/15/25. DT Search can even identify any valid credit card numbers across index data.
And relevancy ranking.
Yeah, DD Search can automatically relevancy rank search results. Say you search for red, blue, or purple. If red and blue are common across index files, but purple relatively rare, then purple mentions will receive a higher relevancy rank, with documents with the densest purple mentions coming out on top. DD Search also supports user-defined variable term weighting, like giving red a positive weight of 7, blue a negative weight of 3, and purple a positive weight of 8, but only if it appears in certain metadata or positionally towards the top or bottom of a file. For a different set of search results.
Sorry about that. And final thoughts.
For a different view of search results, instantly we sort by a new metric like file date or file location. Whatever the sorting, browse through retrieve files with highlighted hits for easy navigation. Yeah, that's kind of the wrap-up. But however you organize or don't organize your terabytes of enterprise data, Enterprise Search can make available instant concurrent searching across all of it. And you can get started at DT Search.
Yeah, ddsearch.com. Very good. Thank you so much. We had a little connection problem there. I apologize. I'm not sure what caused that, but I think I got you. Make sure you check out Elizabeth Thien's work and company's work over at ddsearch.com. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Price. You're listening to The Price of Business. Stay tuned for more after this. Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business Show. The Honorable David Walker, he's a regular on the program, the former Comptroller General of the United States, and really is the Chief Accountability Officer for the country for fiscal accountability. What a tough job. And of course, you know, people can look at that, David, and welcome as always to the show and say, wow, they do a terrible job. But the problem is the entire infrastructure is geared to subvert those objectives. It's amazing that, frankly, you got more done than I would say any Comptroller General. In fact, you probably saved the office during your tenure, and yet how difficult it was to show. It was, by the way, under your tenure that the last two balanced budgets that the United States has had happened. So, you know, you certainly showed up, but what a tough job. And the problems continue. And before we get into our segment today, which is really big news, by the way, I want you to take a moment to talk about your book, which to me is both a warning cry and also a blueprint for going into a different direction before we get started, and give your website as well.
Well, Kevin, it's always good to be with you. The website is AmericaIn2040.com. The book basically is about the challenges facing the United States from a national security, economic security, foreign relations, and domestic tranquility perspective, and the fact that if we want to remain a superpower in 2040 and beyond, we need to start coming to grips with some of these challenges, and the biggest one being putting our finances in order. No country is exempt from the laws of prudent finance. Nobody's going to pay it out to the United States. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when the bubble's going to burst, which would result in a global depression if we don't end up changing course. And the good news is the book talks about lessons from history, lessons from others, and offers sensible solutions that have been supported by a supermajority of a representative group of American voters. Because in the end, you not only have to do things that make sense, you have to do things that are politically feasible in our broken system.
Yeah. And that is a great segue into what we're talking about today, which is a convention of states, which is clearly listed in the Constitution. When Congress won't do its job, I mean, we can't even get them to do the most basic jobs at this point. This entire country runs on continuing resolutions
And those, by the way, are less frequent than executive orders. All I see is executive orders like tomorrow, many of which are going to be proven unconstitutional, as you well know. And so it's about time for some grown-ups to show up, and they don't appear in either party in the Congress. Now, there's something that historically significant that happened in the late 1970s that should have led to a convention of states, which would have led to a balanced, or should have led to a balanced budget amendment. And it was underreported then, and it's been underreported now for almost 50 years. I want you to kind of give us the background on all this. Set the stage for us, if you will, David.
Well, thanks, Kevin. Well, the founders were very bright people. They understood that Congress might become so out of touch and so out of control, or there could be certain issues that needed to be addressed that the Congress either couldn't or wouldn't address it because of conflicts of interest or other matters. And so under Article 5 of the Constitution, which is only one paragraph, and a vast majority of people aren't aware of it, including members of Congress, I might add, that if two-thirds of the states, 34 states, file an application with the Congress for a Article 5 amending convention, meaning not a constitutional convention, a convention that's limited to considering one or more amendments, that the Congress shall call the convention. Well, the not-for-profit that I chair, called the Federal Fiscal Sustainability Foundation, which is FFSF.us, discovered over 3 years ago that we crossed the goal line in 1979 with 39 active applications. We were over the goal line for 25 years. Congress never did anything. And we recrossed the goal line in 2016 and 17, and Congress never did anything. So last Wednesday, which, by the way, was Constitution Day, the chairman of the House Budget Committee, Jody Arrington, Bruce Lee, who's executive director of the Interstate National Federalism Commission, and myself as former Comptroller General and chair of the Federal Fiscal Sustainability Foundation, held a press briefing that provided all the evidential matter and called for the convention to now be set. We'll have to see what Congress does. This is unprecedented. It's never happened in the history of the country. And we've got a number of safeguards in our approach that will limit the convention just to fiscal responsibility. There are other efforts out there for things like term limits, campaign finance, limit the size and scope of government, but they're not close to achieving the required 34 amendments and never have been. Let's do first things first, do this, prove that you can do it, it can work, it won't run away, and then we can consider it for other things that Congress refuses to address, like term limits, campaign finance, et cetera.
Yeah, it makes sense to do one thing at a time. You remember, I mean, I know you know that, you know, many, not just a handful of disgruntled people, many called the Constitutional Convention of 1788 the coup. 1788, because let's face it, the Articles of Confederation was largely toothless, and the Constitution was extremely strong versus the Articles of Confederation. And so that argument is a really common argument against this type of convention. The difference is that one of the many weaknesses of the Articles of Confederation is it didn't have an ability to create guardrails. There's no mentioning of framework or how such would be created. That's not the case with a convention of states.
Well, that's correct. And by the way, there's a lot of confusion out there. There is actually an organization that's called the Convention of States, and it's, you know, by far the most visible, has by far the most money, and it's trying to achieve a convention to be able to consider fiscal responsibility, term limits, and limiting the size and scope of government. You know, I think they've got, around 19 applications now, something like that. But I don't think they'll ever get 34 because they're leading with their chin by wanting to have a convention to address multiple subjects when the biggest argument against an Article 5 convention is it'll run away. And you're exactly right. I mean, the Articles of Confederation didn't have anything like Article 5. And Article 5 is very, very clear. It's only to propose amendments. And by the way, if they propose amendments under the one state, one vote concept, which is how it would work, you got to get 38 states to ratify it. And you're not going to get 38 states to ratify something radical.
Yep. Absolutely. And that's exactly right. I mean, that's all but 12, right? Is my math right? Yeah, that's all but 12 states.
You passed math on that question.
That's okay. Right. What's the saying? I'm good at arithmetic, not so much on math. But anyway, that's a very high threshold. And I think a necessary one. It goes back to what we were talking about the UN. Those, when you're talking about something that impacts an entire nation, you need significant buy-in. You need unanimous is insane. It isn't going to happen, but you need significant buy-in. Actually, you and I were talking about that during the break, I think. Talk a little bit about what the next steps are. What are you envisioning happening, David?
Well, first, at the press briefing, I requested that the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution hold a hearing on this matter, as well as HCON Res 15, which is designed to make sure this doesn't happen again. Okay. Secondly, I think I also requested the House Budget Committee hold a hearing on the need for a statutory fiscal commission, which is important as well. But ultimately, I think what's going to happen, Kevin, is if the Congress doesn't act in a reasonably expeditious manner, and by that I mean this calendar year, I think what we're going to have to do, and Bruce Lee mentioned this, is we're going to have the state sue the Congress. And ultimately, it's going to be an issue that will be decided in the Supreme Court. I hope it doesn't come to that. I don't think that's in the interest of the nation. And it shouldn't require a vote. All it should require is just, them looking at the work that the National Federalism Commission did that confirmed our findings. And if they agree with it, then call the convention.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you actually see, based on the current environment, where at least in the past, Republicans pretended to be fiscally responsible and now they don't care? They don't care. Do you see, it possible to muster that up? And personally, I think Trump will see that, see this as a huge distraction of his often very personal agenda. I don't know. I mean, I think you're going to have a pretty big fight just to get it started.
Two things. One, there's not a party of fiscal responsibility today.
No.
We haven't had a fiscally responsible president since Bill Clinton.
Yep.
But interestingly, just yesterday, it's been brought to my attention right before I got on this call with you that the president posted something on Truth Social yesterday that evidently expressed support for a convention of states. Now, as I said, there's an organization called Convention of States that wants to address three issues at once. What we need to do is let's do first things first. Let's do the most important issue, fiscal responsibility. Let's get that done. Let's prove that the mechanism can work without running away. And then we can address term limits. Then we can address campaign finance. Then we can address other issues that need to be addressed, but Congress refuses to address it.
Yeah. I would assume Trump would like one that covers lots of issues, though. I think he's trying to recreate this government in his own image, personally. See him, in my opinion, trying to do that through executive orders, taking actions against the First Amendment and free speech that are unprecedented. And they're really not unprecedented, just for accuracy. We had similar, the Alien and Sedition Act under John Adams. It's similar to that, which, that's old news, and it got crashed and burnt. Under Woodrow Wilson, similar policies, but this is at a level and a form and a style we've never seen before. So I can see him support this concept. I think he'd probably want an unchecked one. I'm assuming it is rather an expansive one. I'm assuming his post didn't go that much detail.
No, it didn't. And I'm still trying to find out more about it. But, unfortunately, what you have is a situation where you know, states have attorneys general. Attorney generals have standing to sue. There's two other state legislatures that have standing to sue. But most attorney generals want to be governor or want to be senator or something else. And so they don't just look at it from the standpoint of what's the right thing to do. They also look at it from the standpoint, what's it likely to do for my political future? And, most Republican attorney generals don't want to get on the wrong side of Donald Trump. And so
right.
The way I look at it is it's a good thing that he expresses support for the need for some type of convention of states to propose one or more amendments. That's a good thing because, presumably that would mean that there wouldn't be political retribution if one or more states' attorneys general end up suing the Congress for failing to do its job.
Mm-hmm. As long as they do it the way he wants it, it'll be interesting to see how that is, what that is. Obviously, we have to hold judgment on that until he elaborates.
But here's the key. Here's the key. Congress does not have the right to set the terms of anything. You know, the states control the scope of the convention. The states determine whether or not they're going to propose an amendment and what that amendment would be. And while the Congress can while the president can use the bully pulpit to try to influence public opinion, he can end up speaking publicly and privately to members of Congress about what he would like to see happen. The mere fact of calling the convention is express, enumerated, ministerial, and non-discretionary. That's the crux of this whole thing. Congress does not have the authority to say no.
Right.
A
lot of Americans may not be familiar with the history of the way the Constitution was set up. The Constitution, admittedly, the Articles of Confederation were essentially one notch above anarchy. I mean, it really essentially was a free trade agreement. And, you know, a free trade agreement, and if we get attacked by others, we'll help. But the Constitution was heavily designed to have muscle, and muscle's good because otherwise you have chaos. There seems to be limited muscle. And it was designed specifically to protect the states, and that was one of its primary objectives. Proof is in the pudding when you have the U.S. senators being chosen by the governors of states and approved by the Congress all the way into the 20th century. And so that was a very special role. That is how you really defuse centralized power, is through strong states, and that was really at the heart of our Constitution.
Well, as you know, Kevin, most people don't recall the fact that the states created the federal government, not the other way around. That the Constitution is very clear to say that the federal government is supposed to have a limited role and only do things that can't be done by the states or by the people. And at the time that the Constitution was ratified and the federal government was set up, the federal government was 2% of the total economy. Before World War I and before the amendment that created direct election of senators and the income tax, et cetera, those amendments, the federal government was only 3% of the economy. Now the federal government is 24% of the economy and growing. And by the way, since 1979, when the convention should have been called, the debt has gone from less than $1 trillion to over 37, growing rapidly, and the dollar has lost about 80% of its value.
Yep. Yeah. And by the way, it took almost 200 years to get to its first trillion. And now we do it every 6 months and maybe even move faster than that. I mean, it's incredible how it's going now. Great book for people who want to read. It's old. It was written by the late Congressman Phil Crane, who is actually a PhD in history. It's called The Sum of Good Government. And I have never really seen a clearer account of exactly what you're talking about on the power of the intentional power of the state. It was not, oh, look what we ended up doing. It was intentional from day one to design. You know, the powerful offices in the late 19th century, Crane argued and provided evidence, were things like county commissioners. mayors. These guys had way more financial influence than what members of Congress had. And that was not an accident. That was by design. And a very good book. Final thoughts as we wrap it up. We went over what we often do with you. I always have fun with you. Thanks so much, David Walker. Final thoughts.
Good to be with you, Kevin. Well, we live in a great country, but its future is at risk. We've got to put our finances in order. A constitutional amendment is the only way to do it. Find out more at American2040.com and FFSF.us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for being with us. I am Kevin Price. That was the Honorable David Walker, and you're listening to the nationally syndicated Price of Business. Stay tuned for more after this. Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. I like to say it's a show that never ends. And what I mean by that is it continues 24/7 at priceofbusiness.com, where we are always adding new audio, video, articles, and more. While there, make sure you like it on Facebook and follow it on Twitter. Plus, make sure you get our newsletter, Read Instead. One of the people you'll find in that reads that newsletter often is my guest this segment, Lee Kaplan, longtime regular on the program, and frankly, one of the brightest political pundits I talk to, be it international issues all the way to local issues and everything sandwiched in between. Lee, always glad to have you on the program. Take just 1 minute to tell us about your firm and the one best website for people to learn more about it.
Our firm is Murphy Ball Stratton. I'm a senior partner there, and we are a litigation boutique, which means we try cases, we arbitrate cases, we occasionally settle cases on the way to a trial or arbitration. And every one of our lawyers has experience in both courts, state and federal. We range from a Supreme Court to a U.S. Supreme Court clerk to people who clerked on various appellate courts. And our goal is always to get a case resolved, whether by getting ready for trial or arbitration, or along the way, sometimes they settle.
Yep. Yep. And that website, one more time.
It's mbssmartlaw.com. So there are two S's in the middle.
All righty, we got an interesting topic, one that I've been watching closely and really kind of stand in awe of the way it's being perceived or viewed by the vast majority of the people. All of our Bill of Rights, you know, as you will know, we've got these 10 Bill of Rights that really are foundational to our country. Number one, and the one that frankly all other rights largely depend on, is the right to free speech. That's the First Amendment. And we have had nothing short of what I call a crisis in that department last week with what happened with Jimmy Kimmel and the FTC literally using, as one of Trump allies worded it, Ted Cruz, really using mafia-style tactics, pulling language out of a mafia-style movie to threaten ABC if they didn't get into compliance with what Trump wants. This kind of stuff isn't small. You know, I keep hearing people describe the Trump administration as different or, yeah, a little odd, maybe a little harder than we're used to. It's way beyond that, Lee, with what happened with Kimmel. And now he's going back on the air because ABC was facing a financial crisis because of the situation, because of angry mob really taking place. But this kind of stuff can't keep happening. And the fact that it happens even for days chips away at liberty itself, in my opinion. So there's a lot there.
Well, I think the funny thing is the biggest audience that Jimmy Kimmel has ever had will be tonight.
No doubt about it.
And the Sinclair group, which is extremely conservative and maybe Nexstar, say they're not going to carry him. They are losing a lot of money based on their political or philosophical principles because this will be a most watched show. People will wonder just how aggressive he's going to be and what he'll have to say. And I'm wondering what he's going to have to say, and I don't watch Jimmy Kimmel very often.
No.
So I think we can pretty much count on this being a popular show. Probably won't reach the Super Bowl, and you'll probably have a lot of Trumpistas who won't watch it as a matter of principle, but the country will be tuning in tonight to watch Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting.
Talk a little bit, though, about the bigger picture here, because this is, to me, is beyond the realm. I mean, we love to use Richard Nixon as an example of, you know, unchecked corruption. Well, he clearly ended up being very checked. But
well, this is
small potatoes beyond the realm. The stuff that Trump now routinely gets away with, at least momentarily, is stuff that a Nixon wouldn't have even entertained.
Well, the last refuge are the courts. I mean, for example, we have a legislature and a governor in Texas who are completely under the thrall of the Trump regime. And whatever the president wants, the president gets. Greg Abbott falls in line, and you have enough legislators who are afraid of being primaried in the Republican primary that they just go along with it. A lot of these things are silly. I mean, you hear about universities in this state where people cannot discuss opposing views without risking getting fired. You know, some student says, I don't agree with this. They're essentially doing cancel culture off from the right. And I think that's ridiculous.
That's exactly right. Cancel culture doesn't work either way. You know, something that made, you know, the whole Kimmel thing. I don't see Trump 1.0 doing what he's done with his FTC chair, you know, recently with the arm twisting trying to punish Kimmel. That's a 2.0. Let's face it, 2.0 is 1.0 on steroids. I mean, he has a robustness like and really tactics that many of us could not imagine. And that's due to a lot of factors. One of the biggest, of course, is the fact that he does have both houses of Congress. But I would say very close to that is the fact that he doesn't face re-election again. And by the way, I'm not advocating he should. But what I wonder, because there is a referendum on the ballot in 2026 in those legislative races, are so important that he's using what I would call questionable tactics from an ethical perspective to try to get more House seats with the redistricting plans. So if Trump is so much more aggressive in 2.0, what is 2.5 going to be in January 2027?
Well, somebody in his family might encourage him to run again, despite the fact that that's clearly forbidden by the Constitution. Or J.D. Vance may ape everything Trump does so carefully that people will turn to him because he's a younger version of Trump. These are people who really do know better. They have no respect for the Constitution, but raw power. And I think that there'll be enough of a split in the conservative movement that that won't work. I mean, when Ted Cruz just comes out and says, this guy is a mafioso, and frankly, I have to agree with him. There are very few things that I agree with Ted Cruz on, but the fig leaf of his ratings were down. That's really why they canceled him, is disproven by the fact that he's back on the air. So I don't know this guy, Brendan Carr, but he looks to me like a guy who is simply a camp follower of Trump. I don't know where he came from, but he obviously is a Trumpista. And I think people will rebel against that. Maybe I'm too optimistic about common sense of the American people, but I hope not. I hope I'm right.
I hope you're right, too. Yeah, and by the way, of all the responses, you know, thank God someone spoke up, someone prominent like Ted Cruz, but think about all the things he could have criticized Trump on for that action, and he took the most base, most crass, most politically self-interested approach, suspension of individual, you know, First Amendment rights, the the attack on free speech and the First Amendment. No, we don't care about that. His whole entire argument was, what did the Democrats do that to us? That was the whole basis. I'm glad he spoke up. Maybe he knows that's the only thing the GOP will listen to is an existential argument.
Right. Well, that's the most appealing argument that he could make. I cannot believe more senators did not speak up. They are truly cowardly.
So cowardly.
I have a feeling that if Michael Eisner hadn't spoken up, this might have stood. But when somebody who was sort of a revered former CEO turns away from his handpicked choice to be CEO of Disney, that also had, I believe, great influence.
Yeah, thank God he did. So talk a little bit about what you're seeing. So I talked a little bit about the larger implications, the some of the what's next type of thing, which, you know, that Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the theologian who ended up getting killed by Hitler's regime in the last couple of weeks of World War II, really largely trumped up charges. Yes, he was a critic. He was not someone who was involved in actual assassinations attempts against him, but that didn't matter. That was enough to have him killed. You know, but he said, more than evil, Germany suffers from stupidity, is what Bonhoeffer said. And what is stupidity? It's the inability to ask the question of what happens next. That's stupidity.
Right. Well, I'm fearful that the Trump family will be too dominant. I remember how troubled people were when John F. Kennedy picked Robert Kennedy to be his attorney general. I was really too young to understand a lot of that. But that was a bad sign, in my opinion. What's happened since is frightening. The Trump family and the Trump regime has upended all the norms. And I hope that doesn't become the new normal. I hope somebody in the Republican Party steps up and says, we've got to get away from this. And apparently, the Kimmel issue and possibly the vaccination issue will be enough to split them out some, so they will not be monolithic. And hopefully the November 26 elections will point the way for some changes.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see. I'm with you on this. I got a feeling that there will be a lasting impact. You know, I take, for example, the effort by Joe Biden to just blanket forgiveness of student loan debt. It wasn't that long ago when no president would have attempted something like that. Frankly, he did
that resting
on the shoulders of Donald Trump's behavior. That was a very Trumpian action on Biden's part. So every time there's a major abnormality, it really deforms the way we govern. And so he's already done a lot, and we're not even done with the first year.
That's scary. Yeah, we're not. We are, what, 8 months into the Trump 4 years?
Yeah.
And that's frightening. And we'll just
if we don't stay on that course, we don't go anything like normalcy. We don't do that. Biden, I think, did things that was unheard of. I think he did that because, well, look what Trump did. That's all I hear from Republicans is, yes, Trump does stuff that you can criticize, but look at the Democrats. And then the Democrats use the exact same argument. And, you know, there's the old saying of choosing the lesser of two evils. There's also a saying called the evil of two lessers. And really, that's what we have perpetuated in this country. It's incredible what we have to work with.
Each party uses the other's injustice or deviation from the Constitution to justify new excesses. We have to get away from that.
That's right. And that's a good note to end on. Lee Kaplan, always appreciate my time with you. I'm Kevin Price. Stay tuned for more after this on The Price of Business.
Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business Show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business, and we've got a great segment. This is becoming one of my favorites, and I've said that before. I think there's a lost art of feedback out there. In fact, feedback is almost terrifying in our current culture, when it actually is one of those things that we should always be embracing, be it in business or in our personal relationships, our friendships. All of them grow because of feedback, and yet we have a culture that seems to be very paranoid around it. And so I love the series that I'm doing with Joan Hibden. She is a regular on the program, and she is a feedback expert, and she takes businesses to new levels and new heights through the power of feedback. Joan, welcome to the program. Glad to have you back. Take a moment to tell us about your firm and also the one best website for people to get more information about you.
Thank you, Kevin. It's so good to be back on the show. Thanks for having me back. So I am Joan Hibden, and my business is called JDH Insights. And what we do at JDH Insights is we do executive coaching, leadership development. We build really great dynamic teams. And that's where we love to spend our time. The best way to reach me on my website is www.jdhinsights.com. So that's jdhinsights.com.
Yep, and as always, we have a live link for you at priceofbusiness.com. Love this topic today. I think that this is a great example, and I wish business owners would pause and listen to this, because it's so telling. It's telling you what's going on. And we're going to talk about the cost of avoiding feedback, and avoidance is one of the most dangerous words in business and in just interpersonal relationship, isn't it?
It truly is. Avoidance means disconnection, not connection. Avoidance means pushing away from, not pulling into or leaning into relationships. And that's in business and or personally. I'm glad that you brought up the personal too. When we avoid something, it means that we're shying away from it.
Yes, yes. And now in our current culture, we're either inappropriate and in your face. I'm not avoiding. Yeah, but maybe you could be diplomatic. we simply avoid it, you know, like and let the elephant continue to sit in the room and impact the quality of the relationship, the business, etc.
It's such a good awareness, yes, because when we're not connected to somebody, when we're not willing to share what we see in somebody's performance, then nothing changes with their performance. Nothing changes. And so If I've been thinking about this, Kevin, it's quite often that people don't say things because of what? Because they're
anything
afraid
from
of
embarrassment, right? Embarrassment or passive aggressive retaliation. There's a list, right?
Right. There's always a risk by saying something, but there's a big risk when you don't say something. And the biggest risk for businesses when leaders don't give appropriate feedback is that the thing that they're most concerned about, or perhaps the thing that they're complaining about to others, doesn't change and it doesn't get fixed because the person who needs to hear the feedback doesn't know it. And so I have just a quick example, and that is there was a business leader that I knew that was not giving feedback to one of their employees, but the business leader was actually taking on the work for the employee. So the employee was not completing their work as required, as needed, as expected, and so then rather than giving the feedback, the business leader took it on. So the business leader was not only doing their own job, but they were doing parts of the employee's job that reported to them. So we're paying the employee for the full cost of their salary, and they're not doing the full responsibilities of their job. And the business leader is getting burnt out because they've taken on more because they're not giving the feedback to the person who can do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And meanwhile, the employee thinks he's doing fine,
And the employer is developing resentment that will probably lead to some kind of explosion at some point if he doesn't address it in a mature manner.
Yeah, you nailed it. And that's exactly what happens time and time again. The employer gets caught in this trap of thinking that they're doing a good thing by not giving the feedback, the appropriate feedback on the employee not meeting expectations. But to your point, eventually resentment grows and then things explode. And it always comes to that proverbial head where things explode and it doesn't go well. As opposed to just saying to the employee, here's what you're not doing that I expect you to do. What do you need help with? How can we change this trajectory? Are you able to do this job? So it costs organizations billions of dollars by keeping silent.
Yes, and it's interesting because they, in their mind, they develop a narrative that they're victims, right? The employer. The reality is they're volunteers. They're volunteering not to enforce, you know, the responsibility that their employees have. They're literally volunteering to that. And it's really shame on the employer more than the employee.
Yeah, I love how you're saying that they're volunteering to do that. It's not that they're a victim. They're choosing. It's a choice to not say the thing that you see that can be changed.
So I love
that word. Yeah. The employer becomes complicit.
Yeah, two V's. You can remember two V's. In fact, I learned that somewhere, and I'll get in situations where I'm getting discontented and irritated with someone, and I'll ask myself, okay, are you being a volunteer here or a victim?
Mm-hmm.
And usually I'm being a volunteer, but I thought I was a victim.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good calculus to look at my interaction with others. It's very
absolutely
powerful.
Well, and I love, Kevin, how you ask the question, like, why am I discontented? What is going on here for me? And a lot of leaders don't pause, and they're not conscious enough to pause and ask that question. What is really frustrating me about this situation? And often it's at the root of, oh, the employee is not doing what I expect them to do. Oh, they're not doing it. So what am I going to do about that? How can I help the employee do the thing that I expect them to do?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Talk about how do you begin, because you see, I kind of operate from the assumption, you know, assuming you can't get you in trouble, but when I look at what's going on in the larger culture, in all areas, including business, when I look at that situation, there is just a real fear of being told you're wrong.
Mm.
And there's a fear. You know, instead of looking at it as a great tool for improvement, which is how I think it should be looked at, and I think we may have done a better job in earlier generations, instead it is to be avoided. Avoided was a perfect way for you to word it. Where do you start? Where do you start? Because so many of these businesses have acquired a culture that was kind of poison even before they got hired.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Because they carry so much of this negativity about feedback. I have to rank it in like one of the top three most important things for culture in a business, maybe number one. And yet we avoid it like the plague. So where do you start when your business is stuck this way?
Well, where I start is I start with helping businesses understand how to normalize feedback. And to bring the topic of feedback into the conversation and into the culture. And it can be, you know, it can be by asking people when you're interviewing them for a job, by asking them, how do you like to receive feedback? Because we have a feedback culture here. We want to make sure that you're staying on course, that you're performing well, and we want to know if you have feedback for us. So it's a two-way street. So you begin to normalize the topic of feedback in the interview process, during the onboarding process. If you're already in the business and the employees are already in the business, then you bring it up as a point of focus for maybe the upcoming quarter, the upcoming year, but you begin to talk about feedback and asking and letting people know that it's important that as an employer that you receive feedback on what you could be doing better or different. Or what you're doing well. I mean, goodness, we all want to hear what we're doing well. But also to let employees know that you're going to start letting them know what they're doing well and what they could be doing better or different. and you begin to start to shift it so that you're normalizing it. And then you begin to come up with phrases or words that help to ease into giving the feedback. And those phrases and words could be, you know, Kevin, I noticed that one thing that you do really well is when we get on the, you know, when we get on this show, you're great at introducing who it is that you're going to speak with. And you do it with such enthusiasm that it makes the person, in this case me, feel good. So that's, you know, so I noticed that you do that really well. And here's something that I noticed that you could do a little bit better. And then you share with the person what they could do better. And it begins to shift the whole nature of how feedback is heard and how it's felt. But you have to practice it.
Yeah, I love this. And really what it comes down to is demystifying feedback, right?
Mm.
I think we live in a culture where feedback has gotten a bum rap. I really do, for the things we've talked about. And so what you're describing, so like with me and my employees, the people that are working for me and our media, my team, if you will, they before they were hired, they clearly had work experiences that were very authoritarian. I can tell. I can see that. And I spent a lot of time saying, wow, I blew it today. I did dot, dot, dot. And sometimes, you know, I even make a bigger deal out of my mistake than it even was, just to say mistakes aren't a big deal, you know, to create that kind of viewpoint, you know, because they need to hear that. I tell them all the time because, you know, I think employees are so terrified that there's a strong, you know, what they would call yes man culture. And I tell them all the time, well, you know, thank you for your compliments. But in my case, I don't get any value from compliments. I get value on feedback on how whatever it is I'm working on can be improved. So feel free to give that. And I endorse them for that. Sometimes I come up with additional rewards from that, because that is the lifeblood of an organization. If you want mediocrity, create a culture where people can't get feedback.
Yep, I would agree. Because people are noticing it and they're talking about it. They're just not talking about it to you or to the person who can actually do something about it.
Yeah.
And without that information, we're not developing healthy relationships.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do we have time for a quick story?
I love the old saying. What's that?
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I love the old saying of Gandhi. Gandhi, you know, said, if you need change, be the change.
Mm.
And I'm telling you, corporate America needs change when it comes to feedback, really a lot of areas. But I would put that among the higher list of priorities. And be the change. Just be the change. Demonstrate what you want from your employees. Yes, go right ahead. Your story will be our final thought as well.
Okay, so just a small quick story, and it's a personal story that a friend shared with me. And he actually helped to change the trajectory of like something that was being served for dinner. So he was having dinner with his wife, his son, and his daughter-in-law. And while they were eating dinner, he asked his daughter-in-law, so what do you think about this particular dish that Susie made? Susie's a fiction name. But the daughter-in-law went, you know, it's not for me. And he looked at her and he said, I really appreciate your giving feedback. And thank you for giving honest feedback about this meal. Because if you had said that you loved it, Susie may have made it every time you came over. So thanks for letting us know.
Great thought to end on. I'm very candid, by the way, Joan, when it comes to your food. I have no. I'm polite, but candid. That is a great note to end on. Joan, I've got about a minute left before my next segment. We went over, but you're worth it. Give me your website to wrap it up again.
Thank you so much, Kevin. My website is www.jdhinsights.com. So that's jdhinsights.com.
I'm Kevin Price. That is Joan Hibden. Thanks so much for being with us. Thank you for more after this.
That wraps up another Price of Business. I am...
Glad to be with you. Really enjoyed it and enjoying our new home here on these stations around the country. I do want to remind you that the show continues 24/7. Not only do we have this weekly show that you can hear on this station, but we're on other stations around the country with a daily program as well. You can easily learn about them by visiting us at priceofbusiness.com. We affectionately say it is the show that never ends. And what we mean by that is that it continues 24/7 with the addition of new audio, video, articles, and more at priceofbusiness.com. While there, we'd like you to engage with us on social media. Follow us on Facebook and, like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Kevin Price Live and all of our sister sites as well. All right, I'm going to take a break until next time. Next week, we'll be back with you with much more information for you, and look forward to that conversation. And I want to say, again, thank you to USA Business Radio to make it possible for this to have been commercial-free, an entire hour of commercial-free. And guess what? Even more commercial-free than public radio. So we're excited about that. Enjoy the rest of your day right here on this station.